Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Big Unlock podcast. My name is Ritu Obroy, and I'm your co-host today along with Rohit. I'm the managing partner here at Big Rio and Demo and host of the Big Unlock podcast. Really happy to have our listeners here today and welcoming Dr. Klasko to the podcast. So happy to have him here today. He's one of the most provocative voices reimagining the future of healthcare. In 2024, Becker's Hospital Review named him as one of the great leaders in healthcare. He's been awarded by Fast Company as one of the top most creative people in business by Modern Healthcare as the number two most influential person in healthcare and by EY as the entrepreneur of the year. Former CEO of Jefferson Health, he led the transformation into a national model for innovation, scaling it into a 14 plus hospital system, and also the co-author of UnHealthcare, a manifesto for health assurance, where he challenges the industry to move beyond sick care towards true health assurance. And today, as an advisor and investor working with organizations like General Catalyst, he's helping build the next generation of digitally enabled patient-centered care models. And known for questioning long-held assumptions, Dr. Klasko continues to push healthcare leaders to rethink not just how care is delivered, but why the system even exists in its current form. So really happy to have you with us, Dr. Klasko. And with that, I'll pass it on to Rohit for a very brief intro and then all yours. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Ritu. Hi, everyone. I'm Rohit. I'm the CEO for Big Rio and also the co-host of the Big Unlock podcast. It is a pleasure to have you, Steve, on the podcast. We had such a wonderful presentation from you at Cornell Tech recently. So over to you. Looking forward to an engaging session. Thank you.
Well, thanks. You guys did a better introduction than I could have done. So I'll just, when you're 72 and you have like five different careers, we would take the whole half hour. So what I told somebody at a Forbes conference, a young woman that came up to me and said, it seems like everybody knows you. I said, look, I'm 72. I've been a healthcare leader for 40 years. I'm still vertical. And my first five Google pages are still positive. And there's only about 10 people that can say all four of those things. So maybe that's the best way to introduce myself. But the simple answer is I started my career as a DJ. I'm a high-risk obstetrician, delivered about 1,500 babies in a private practice in Pennsylvania and Florida through a series of events. Got my MBA at Wharton. Became one of the leaders in what makes doctors different than normal people and how we handle change. Became the dean of a couple of different medical schools, including one where we started a class that we chose based on self-awareness, empathy, communication skills, and cultural competence, and not just memorizing the Krebs cycle. Then became CEO of two different academic medical centers, University of South Florida, which interestingly is not in South Florida, it's in Northwest Florida. It tells you everything you need to know about the logic of Florida. And then Jefferson, which as you mentioned, we grew from a about a $1.5 billion to a hospital entity to an 18 hospital healthcare at any address with an insurance company. And I think one of the things I'm most proud of, we merged our 200-year-old health science university that I was president of with the number three design university and created the first MD master's in design of the human experience in healthcare. Met Hemant Taneja when our mission became becoming a 200-year-old academic medical center, thinking like a startup company. And really came up with the model of what if a Silicon Valley entrepreneur and a CEO of an academic medical center had a baby? What would that baby look like? And so we tried to create a Jefferson. And in some respects, that's what we're doing at GC now that we've acquired a health system, SUMA, which we spent a lot of time talking about this last week in San Francisco, and have created healthcare, health assurance partners like WellSpan and others. So it's sort of taking both sides. If you read Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, you know, both sides of the galaxy, the tech galaxy and the traditional healthcare ecosystem galaxy, recognizing that neither one has the answers and trying to morph them together.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction. And three questions, you know, straight away from whatever you've said. So let's start with the first one. You've talked about healthcare at any address for years, telehealth, distributed care, digital front doors. And, you know, COVID really normalized that. But we still haven't seen that system come fully to scale. And what is the problem there? And why do you think that, you know, that entire digitization or digital front door hasn't happened so far?
Yeah, so I'll probably start with two quotes. I mean, one is from Peter Diamandis, who said, you know, the problem with disruption is it disrupts your current line of business. And we haven't been willing, insurers haven't been willing to disrupt their current line of business. Hospitals haven't, but we all talk about it. Yeah. I mean, we talk about value-based care like it's some myth, some Greek mythology myth, but it's a myth. because we haven't figured out how to make that work yet, by and large. And I can give you a couple examples where we have. And then probably one of my mentors was a guy named Bill Kissick, who wrote a book 45 years ago, Medicine's Dilemmas, Infinite Needs, Finite Resources. Sound familiar? And he was the first one to talk about the iron triangle of access, quality, and cost. And if you remember your ninth grade geometry, you increase one angle, you got to decrease another. So if you're going to increase access, you're either going to increase cost or decrease quality. He said, unless you're willing to disrupt the system, and disruption is painful. So it's hard to be non-political nowadays, but if you want to be at a cocktail party and be non-political, he said, if anybody ever tells you 45 years ago that they're going to increase access, increase quality, and decrease cost, and it's not going to be painful, they're not telling the truth. So in a non-political way, President Obama, the day after the ACA, said, good news, the ACA will increase access, increase quality, and decrease cost, and it's not going to be painful to anybody. Whether that was advertent or inadvertent, that clearly wasn't true. Trump said mine will be fantastic, terrific, unbelievable, and really huge, and it was none of the four. So the question in this layered system, in every other disruption of every other sector, you know, whether it's Uber and taxis or whether it's Amazon and retail, literally folks that haven't been willing to be disrupted and fundamentally changed what they've done have gone away. Think Sears and Penny's. Or on the other side, Circuit City thought they could go OE. And the others said, holy moly, this is real.
Yes.
Figured out how to model their model and have that work with the new model. Think Target and Walmart. So that's what, by and large, is happening at this moment. This is the first time in our history where just about everybody's hurting. You know, we've had time where hospitals ruled the roost and told insurers what to do. For the last 10 or 15 years, the payers came to me and said, if you don't do this, I'll send all my patients to the thing, United Healthcare. I mean, all you have to look at is since the ACA, where you say, oh, I better sell all my stocks that are middlemen, because that's what happened when Amazon did. United Healthcare was the second best stock other than Apple, and it's a middleman. But they're hurting and the hospitals are hurting. So the simple answer is, until we recognize that the system is broken, fragmented, expensive, and inequitable, and probably unsustainable, although we've been saying that for a long time, something has to give. It really is like Hurricane Katrina, where everybody said the levees weren't going to make it till the levees didn't make it. And we are literally at that point, I think, in healthcare.
Wow. Yeah, I totally agree with you. And even at Cornell Tech, I think, you know, this is something I actually wrote down from your speech, that true change can't be incremental and slow. It has to be jolting and it has to hurt people. So,
and people have to fail. Like I said, Sears and Penny's failed. Mm-hmm. Circuit City said, oh my God, we're going to go all E. They failed. I did a lot of work with Target and Walmart when I took over Jefferson. And their whole philosophy was, look, we're really good at what we do. We're not going to abandon that. But we have to be just as good as Amazon at what they do. And in one case, they bought an e-platform. In another case, they created an e-platform. That was an aha moment for me, because I said, look, you know, at Jefferson, we have one of the best pancreatic cancer surgeons in the world, a guy named Dr. Charlie Yeo. If you have pancreatic cancer, you don't give a darn what our digital health strategy is, what our, how big our TV is, or what our food is. You want to see Dr. Yeo. We have people from around the world come to see Dr. Yeo. But for the other 97% of people in Philadelphia that don't wake up in the morning thinking they're a patient, all we could do is say, come to my office, come to my ER, come to my urgent care center, come to my hospital. None of them wanted to do any of that. They wanted to be a patient with diabetes or congestive heart failure or COPD that could thrive without having to think about it. And one of our first big successes at General Catalyst was Livongo. We sold for $18.4 billion. And all that did, when you really think about Livongo, and say, we'll be your invisible friend if you have diabetes. And we partner with Livongo. And they say, look, Clasco's great, but he's great if you need to go to his office, urgent care center, ER, or hospital. But that's not what you're going to do 97% of the time. We'll be there for the other 97% of the time. That's what we have to learn. That's what tech and payers and health systems have to work together. And the ones that can do that and start to disrupt that access, quality, user experience, and cost thing will succeed.
Yeah, I think that's also leading up to the new era, where I think you also talked about that, and maybe that was in some of the other presentations, that, you know, the whole idea of this annual wellness visit is going to be so outdated, because you have this constant stream of information now coming in from wearables, and you need these AI companions, and you need the, you know, people are so used to asking for everything on demand that they need to really get that information. The whole model of, you know, actually going into the doctor's office, seeing the doctor, and then waiting to get that information is going to be outdated very soon. So
the annual visit is a farce.
Exactly.
All right. Think about this. Imagine if your whole finances and everything you invested was, you know, okay, we're going to check in once a year and just ignore it. You know, oh, by the way, there was an Iran war in between, or, you know, 4 years ago, inflation ticked up. Yep. But we'll just check you. I mean, I had my Mayo Executive Wellness, and, you know, they give you all this stuff, exercising, how you're going to lose weight and all this. I'm a marathon runner. 2 days later, I tore my hamstrings. So everything they told me,
it doesn't apply anymore.
If they had gotten the data from my Oura Ring, they would have said, hey, Steve, you were running 25 miles a week and you sort of stopped on Tuesday. We'd like to talk to you, right? Well, yeah, I didn't just stop. I did a face plant because I tore my hamstrings and got them surgically reattached. So my new book's going to be called, as I told you at the talk, Swifty Startups and the Singularity, where I come back from 2035. I'm the chief digital health officer for President Taylor Swift, because the Swifties have become a political party. We could do worse. And our healthcare motto is make healthcare Taylor to make it Swift, neither of which was true in 2026. And one of the breakup songs, if you remember, was we are never, ever, ever going back together with annual physicals. Even the term physical is an asinine term, because it means, okay, I'm going to check everything once a year from the neck down. Steve, you know, I mean, and one of the companies I'm involved with, Neuroflow, literally, you know, one of the studies they did is that people that have tried or have committed suicide, about 30% of them have seen their primary care doc within the last 4 or 5 months.
Oh, really?
Okay. They had a physical and they didn't connect what may have been a warning sign. I mean, Neuroflow actually really connects those warning signs. So I think the whole issue of continuous health narratives, and, you know, having much more sophisticated wearables. I had a cardiac bypass 2 years ago and had it done at a place that I was at with a friend of mine. I left on day two. Actually, I was DJing for the nurses on day two, but I left on day two. And the typical cardiac rehab would be like in about 5 weeks, I'd go and sit in a waiting room so somebody could put a whole bunch of things on me. And I go on a treadmill. Well, I'm a marathon runner. I said, I ain't doing that. So I talked to my cardiologist and we connected my Oura Ring and my Apple Watch data. And he had me walk, starting week two. Yeah. And he watched heart rate variability, and then I walked more. So I did it all from my home at a much lower cost. I was back to running within probably 8 weeks, where I would have just been starting walking on a treadmill in a traditional way. So this whole healthcare day address not only makes it easier at any address, but allows you to customize things, because a lot of people with bypasses are sedentary, heavy people that haven't done any exercise. But that's the one size fits all thing we have in American medicine.
I
had an autoimmune issue with a cholesterol of 107 and was 140 pounds. So I didn't need to get on a walking treadmill to prove that I could walk.
Absolutely. So Dr. Klasko, you've been championing radical collaboration between health systems and Silicon Valley. And you've been doing that for a while, and you mentioned Suma. But in practice, what is the biggest failure you've seen where, you know, collaboration looked good on paper, but, you know, in the real world, due to culture, incentives or ego, that's not going to happen?
I think you answered your own question. Your culture is an ego, right? I mean, I can expand on that. I think, first of all, here's what we hear from health system CEOs now that I'm on the other side. We're tired of putting all the Lego pieces together for all the point solutions your 28-year-old founders create. All right. So I think I answered a question at Cornell about this, but, you know, I'm on the board or advisor to 5 different, very, very good women's health AI and technical companies that are handling different parts of women's health: fertility, menopause, the vaginal microbiome, pregnancy. Well, why don't they all get together and say, throughout a woman's life, we can now do more of this at home? Well,
yes,
you said it. It's the founder's ego. And I have to sometimes explain to these companies, you're not going to create an IPO based on dense breasts or vaginal microbiome or one part of a woman's life, like fertility. So I think that's one thing. I think the second thing is that we haven't been that successful in the past. I mean, as one CEO told me, you spent 40 years telling us, Steve, that technology would make our life easier.
Yes.
Starting with what he called the epidemic, right? EHRs would make our life easier. Well, all it did was create more administrators. There's some real skepticism that AI isn't just our new cool EHR thing. So that's the second thing. And then the third thing, I think you mentioned the incentives. One of the really, really cool things I think we did at Jefferson is I wrote an article a long time ago called I'm Never Getting Fleeced Again.
Okay.
It was when I was at University of South Florida. I won't mention the company, but the CEO came to me in 2009. And it was like a virtual health company even back then. And he said, Steve, I just want you to know, I want to take you out to dinner. We could not have done it without you. You were our first advisor. USF was our first client. We wouldn't even be around without you or USF. So I want to take you out to dinner. Why do you want to take me out to dinner? Oh, we just got valued at $800 million. I said, oh, well, that better be a hell of a dinner then, because we didn't get anything out of that. He goes, oh, no, I'm also going to send you and your staff four fleeces. So my article was, I'm never getting fleeced again, that if I'm really involved in creating billion-dollar companies, because, you know, yeah, I was a more entrepreneurial CEO than most, and I got excited about these things. So Jefferson, and part of the, you know, way we met Haymont, we literally put a GC person on our cabinet, and we co-developed. So companies like Comure, we gave them total access to all our doctors and our systems, but we also had an opportunity to gain equity. It wasn't any kind of pay to play. It was just they were getting, you know, literally stuff that they could never get. And we were partners. So I didn't feel, you know, when Comure became a big company, I didn't feel that I got, hey, I helped create this billion-dollar company and I didn't get anything for it. For Jefferson, when I say I, Jefferson, for Jefferson's perspective, it was a great opportunity to be a portfolio diversifier, which is what every health system needs, right? I mean, if you're struggling to make a 2% margin on your hospital business, and we're at a point where investments, you just can't depend that this market's going to continue to grow by 10 or 15%, you're getting less and less from the insurers. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, there's $30 billion being spent on digital health and somebody's making a lot of money and they can't make it without you. Like, you don't need to be a genius to say, well, how do I do that in a legal and ethical way? And I think that's what I talk to, you know, hospital system CEOs and boards about.
Nice.
In my mind, Steve, I'm thinking about, you know, the way the hospitals are set up are all not-for-profit. And that's in the DNA, right? You kind of like, it's, you know, you've been a CEO of a hospital system, probably it was not-for-profit. And now you have a private equity company, you know, coming in, let's say with the Suma partnership, General Catalyst, which is clearly driven by profit. And, you know, the shareholders and, you know, the investors are expecting a return. In my mind, I'm just trying to think, how do you bring those two together?
I have been on the board or CEO of three different kinds of health systems, quote, not-for-profit health systems, for-profit health systems, and religious faith-based institutions. So here's what I'd say. By and large, across the board, the faith-based institutions were the most mission-driven and the least profitable. And again, any stereotype, but at least the ones I was involved with, that was true. We started every board meeting with, you know, what our mission was, what, you know, et cetera. When you get outside of that, the quote not-for-profit hospitals and the quote for-profit hospitals, it's much more variable. I have seen not-for-profit hospitals that talk about nothing other than, can we get this donor to give us a lot of money? Can we do this? Where are we? U.S. News and World Report compared to our competitor? How do we beat them in research? And I have, you know, talked to folks like Jonathan Perlin, who was the chief medical officer for HCA, and now runs Jayco, you know, and he would get angry about that because he would say, you know, we probably did more to normalize obstetric care through our quote for-profit system. And I think, you know, Chip Kahn, who's the head of the Federation of American Hospitals, which is the for-profit health systems, has said, look, you know, the difference is that we pay taxes. Because after EMTALA and everything else, now, when I say that, there are absolutely for-profit systems that I wouldn't want to be part of. But by the way, there are not-for-profit systems that I wouldn't want to be part of. Now, when you get to GC, I think it's hard for people to recognize this, but it really, really, really is a whole different situation. And I know it's easy for me to say, but you know, we wrote that book on healthcare, A Manifesto for Health Assurance, and we called it a manifesto, right? I mean, think about other manifestos. They all haven't worked out, the Communist Manifesto. Sure. But it was meant to be a call to arms.
Yeah.
And Haymont who was my partner writing that book and, you know, who I have the honor of working for now, made a decision that in order for us to really, really actualize that, we have to prove it.
Yeah.
And we did not go and acquire, sorry, folks from Akron, Ohio, but we did not go and acquire, you know, a sexy LA profitable entity. We acquired Summa Health, literally in the middle of the country, Akron, Ohio. Literally in about the middle of how health systems are doing, you know, they weren't going bankrupt, literally in the upper middle in quality, but, you know, not what everybody was talking about. And literally probably in the middle of size of a couple $1 billion few hospital system with a small insurance company. So the fact is, and we have this thing called responsible innovation, we didn't invest a few $100 million in there to come back with a quick profit. I mean, honestly, it's a 10-year type thing.
Great.
You know, which is frankly, partly why it's not the part that I'm most involved with, because I'm 72, and unless they're building assisted living facilities, but it's exciting. And I think it's done for the right reason.
Awesome. Yeah.
It frustrates me because I've been doing this for 40 years. And, you know, you go to Health Evolution or Forbes, or, and if you came down from March, you'd think we have the most equitable, fair healthcare system, because everybody's talking about what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And we've been talking about some of the same transformations for 4 years. The quote I used at Cornell was, Jason Kidd, who was an NBA player, came to the Dallas Mavericks, they were 24 and 52. He said, I'm going to turn this team around 360 degrees. We do a lot of turning things around 360 degrees. I'm hoping the people that listen to the Big Unlock podcast, people that went to the Cornell Health Tech Summit, are willing to say, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And we're not turning things around 360 degrees anymore. So that's my hope.
Thank you. So much. Lovely to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care, guys.